Welcome back. In the past decade and a half, nearly one in five newspapers has folded, leaving thousands of communities as so-called news deserts. Small publications in particular have suffered. In Virginia, seven counties are without community news sources. And in Maryland, many papers that were once robust rely on just a handful of reporters. So what's the connection between local news and an informed public? And on this election day, how does local journalism affect voter turnout? Joining me to discuss this is Penny Muse Abernathy. Penny Muse Abernathy is the Knight Chair in Journalism and Digital Media Economics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She joins us by phone. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Joining me in studio is Alexa Mills, editor of Washington City Paper. Alexa, good to see you again.
Thank you. Good to see you.
And also in studio is Doug Tolman, senior editor of Montgomery County Media. Doug Tolman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Penny, I'd like to turn to you first. You authored the study on so-called news deserts. What were some of the main findings in the report?
Well, one of the things we wanted to do was document both the real loss, the loss of news outlets, as well as the diminishment of news. And I think if you look at the Washington metro area, it represents both the threat as well as the possibility of reinventing news and other news organizations coming in to fill the void that's been left. As you mentioned, one in five communities that had a newspaper in 2004 do not have a newspaper today. And why is that important? Because local newspapers have traditionally been the prime, if not the sole source, of the news and information that feeds our democracy at the grassroots level. So they do that in a number of ways around election time. They highlight the important issues. They highlight the stands that the candidates have. They do profiles on the candidates on everything from your town council board all the way up to your state elections, some of which we don't even know why we are electing some of those people and what they actually do. So they also do the vetting for us, too, of bringing those candidates in. And historically, they provided us with a kind of a roadmap for who votes for what and who a newspaper thinks is going to do a better job of representing us or taking a stand on issues that are important to the community.
Which communities in our region have lost such news outlets?
Well, primary of the 1,800 news outlets that have been lost, roughly about 1,750 are weekly newspapers. So if you look at Maryland, it is the loss of the 20 Gazette papers that were owned at one point by the Washington Post. So you've had that those newspapers actually go out of business. They are no longer published. And you have had other newspapers that have been in the area, from the Current to the Chronicles, struggling financially, as most newspapers are, as they attempt to make a digital transformation.
It is election day. How does the absence of a community news source affect voter participation?
Well, there have been quite a number of studies, and the studies have been consistent in finding that, especially in off-election years, it's very difficult to get information about candidates. In a national election, we tend to pull along information about lots of other candidates that are also running, but especially in off-election year, it's very difficult to get the information, and as a result, voter turnout typically goes way down.
Doug, you were once editor of the Montgomery County Gazette, a publication important for its attention to the hyperlocal. It folded in 2015. What are your thoughts on how and why local papers affect people's civic participation, including voting and voter turnout, as Penny just mentioned?
Well, I run into people every day who say they miss the Gazette because of the news it provided, especially during an election year. There's been so many stories out of Montgomery County this election that have been covered superficially by what's remaining, but nobody's done like the deepest dive into what's been going on. There are people who've tried. Where I work, we try. There are a number of good blogs that have done a fair job, but I don't think it's the same job that the Gazette reporters would have done if they still existed.
But of course, you're now with Montgomery County Media, and I'll say it if you want. I think Montgomery County Community Media does a pretty good job of covering local issues. But what was your response when the Gazette ceased publication, because when it ceased publication, it was owned by Jeff Bezos.
I had left the paper before then. They had done a salary dump, I guess, essentially in the November previous. But I was still very close to the staff. I'd hired most of the reporters. I'd hired most of the editors. We were a pretty close-knit bunch. And when Jeff Bezos bought the Post, he told the Post staff that he wasn't expecting them to do local news. So we thought he was leaving us a lane where we could...
I should mention to our listeners that that Jeff Bezos acquired the Gazette newspapers as a part of the deal in buying the Washington Post.
Absolutely. So we thought we would be left alone and that whatever he provided the Post, at least in terms of expertise, we would get it too. And... nothing arrived, and we slowly diminished till the point where we folded in, I believe it was the middle of 2015. And I remember the day I was driving to work that day, got a call from another former staffer, and he said, they're calling everybody in. It doesn't look good. And I said, oh, no, they'll go online only. They'll do this. They'll do that. There's a lot of things they can do before they close.
Alexa Mills, it was around this time last year when you came on this show because Washington City Paper was on the brink of folding. Remind us why and tell us what happened in the interim.
Yeah, it was a very different picture. About exactly 1 year ago, I came on because our parent company, Southcom, had announced that they wanted to offload their five alt-weeklies, which were in five different cities in the United States, and we were one of them. So I was here. You know, I remember I had gathered with my staff before coming and come up with a list of arguments why should City Paper survive, and had sort of come into the studio armed with that list and prepared to make every argument I could for someone to buy City Paper. Unfortunately, someone did.
Well, I was about to say, you made that argument sitting in front of me. I didn't have deep enough pockets, but what was the case that you did make for keeping City Paper around?
You know, a lot of the things that we're already just talking about in the first few minutes of this segment, we were arguing that we provide a lot of local community news and that we wanted to continue that and we wanted to, if possible, do more. That was our argument, that we hope to be a community newspaper and we hope to provide people with good information. And ultimately, Mark Ein stepped in and bought us.
Mark Ein is a local business entrepreneur who also happens to own the Washington Castles, the tennis group that plays here every summer. Back to you, Penny. We've seen a number of papers bought by wealthy entrepreneurs, including the Washington Post, which is both a national news outlet, but also our hometown newspaper, bought in 2013 by Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. But in your report, you talk about new media barons. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think there are two types of media barons. There are the moguls that have made their reputation and their money elsewhere, who come in and see a need to have good, strong journalism. And they come in, they invest in the human capital that makes a newspaper great. Jeff Bezos investing in the Washington Post is one example of someone having a vision to take a paper and make it into both a national and a global force for covering certain types of news. There are other types of media barons that have arisen in the wake of the 2008 collapse of the economy, and which also brought down tons of papers. It's put the squeeze on the profit margins of just about all papers, which had relied until then almost primarily on print advertising, and many of those papers went bankrupt, and in their wake in swooped private equity, hedge funds, and publicly traded equity funds that swooped in, purchased these newspapers as part of a broad portfolio. And in contrast to the media barons that had come before, they didn't have that sort of journalistic sensibility, and their primary goal was shareholder return. So if you're in a portfolio that includes real estate, pharmaceuticals, financial services, ultimately your fate depends on the return you give the shareholders.
Which is the difference between when Eugene Meyer, Catherine Graham's father, bought a bankrupt Washington Post in 1933, his only interest was in being in the newspaper business.
That's right. That's correct. And if you look at the chains that arose in the latter part of the 20th century, whether it was a Knight Ridder or a McClatchy or a Washington Post, which owned several newspapers outside of Washington, or a New York Times, which owned several papers outside of New York, their primary interest was on serving the communities where they were located. So that included providing public service journalism.
Here is Kevin in Silver Spring, Maryland. Kevin, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. I just wanted to talk a bit about another issue that happens when local newspapers close. There was a recent study done by the University of Chicago that documented that cost for bonds for local governments has increased by as much as 11% when local newspapers closed. And that was a study that covered closure of news outlets between 1996 and 2015. And what it shows is that when there isn't a watchdog on city government, that spending increases. And while the citizens aren't watching, those who float bonds certainly are. So the cost of government is a direct increase in relation to local newspapers closing.
Care to comment on that, Penny Muse Abernathy?
Yeah, that was an excellent study, and I was glad to see it. It looked at some of the larger cities, but I think that is a common problem on even the smallest municipalities. I spoke to a group of county communicators and city communicators in North Carolina back in the spring, and that was exactly the anxiety they voiced about not having someone who routinely covered town council meetings, who routinely covered zoning meetings, who routinely covered the school board. All of them noticed that where they noted that where in the past they had had numerous reporters from both the metro papers or even regional large regional dailies show up at their town council meetings when there was an important issue. Now no one even showed up, and as a result, what happens in many small towns is the only account of what occurs in a town council meeting is the Facebook account that is put up by the mayor or the town council member.
Indeed, we talk here a lot about WAMU News, and on this broadcast especially, the politics are about keeping local officials, whether elected or appointed, accountable and keeping an eye on government. Alexa, do you feel optimistic now about the future of city paper?
Yeah, I do. I think that the future is bright for city paper. I think that we're in a learning phase and are exploring a number of different models. One of the conversations I had was with a city paper alum named Mike Kanan. He worked for the paper as a City Lights editor, but now is a publisher at a newspaper in Texas, the Texas Observer. And one of the things he says is that you have to try everything. You have to try membership and advertising and, you know, print advertising and events. And he runs an award. And I think that city paper is in that exploratory phase where everything's on the table. And
is that the kind of advice you would give for, say, the staff of the Virginian Pilot, a publication which Tribune Publishing purchased 5 months ago and which may, again, be sold to the highest bidder?
Oh, I would think I would shy from giving anyone advice. I'll stick with journalism. I'm the editor.
I hear you. Well, somebody who might be able to give advice in that regard is Stephen Waldman. He is president and co-founder of Report for America, an organization that places emerging journalists in community newsrooms around the country. He joins us from studios in New York City. Stephen Waldman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Steve, I'd like to talk about other models for local reporting. For listeners who might not be familiar with Report for America, can you explain what it is?
Yeah, it's sort of loosely modeled after AmeriCorps or Teach for America. And we basically recruit really, really talented emerging journalists from around the country. And then we place them into local newsrooms to do really critically important local reporting. There's a competition, actually two competitions. News organizations compete in order to get some of these reporters, and reporters compete to get those slots. And then we at Report for America pay half the salary. The other half of the salary is paid by a combination of the newsroom and local donors, because part of our premise is that in the long run, community journalism is only going to survive if the community supports it. And we started about a year ago. We have 13 reporters out in the field now. We're going to have about 30 next year. And it's really trying to revive the idea of local journalism as a public service.
Was that your motivation, you and Charles Sennott? Charles Sennott founded this organization. Was that your motivation?
It was, practical and spiritual, I would say. The practical part of it really was dealing with the issue that you've been discussing, is the collapse of local journalism has posed a tremendous threat to democracy. And to break that down a little bit, it's democracy in the abstract sense, about the political system, about voting, being an informed voter. But it's also just the practical information that people need to live their lives, you know, whether the drinking water is clean or whether the schools are improving or things like that, where we're not even conscious of the ways that local news can help families to, you know, make life decisions and hold people accountable. So, and then the last reason, I think, which is a little more subtle, is that the collapse of local news, I think, has contributed to polarization. We have less and less ability to have local discussions about local issues. The vacuum is kind of filled by national cable news and people caricaturing each other. So the local newspaper, one of the functions they played was to help neighbors know each other, help the community understand itself. That's also one of the things that have gone away.
How many Report for America Corps members are there, and where do they land across the country?
So the first class is 13. Next class will be about 30. And the goal is to have 1,000 reporters in the field within 5 years. And they're spread all over the country. We have two in West Virginia at the Charleston Gazette Mail and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. There's one in Eastern Kentucky, Dallas, Chicago, Macon, Georgia. In each case, two in Mississippi. In each case, the newsroom basically has to say, in order to get a Report for America reporter, they have to say what their gaps are. What's the gap in coverage that's important to people, and how will you use this reporter to cover it? So we're not interested in placing people into newsrooms and have them, you know, man the Twitter feed. We want them to cover, you know, healthcare or education or whatever the local editors decide are really important gaps in coverage. And that can be an issue, it can be a population, it can be an ethnic group. In Eastern Kentucky, for instance, where they're placed in the Lexington Herald Leaders organization, they had one reporter covering 24 counties in Eastern Kentucky. So they placed the Report for America reporter, Will Wright, in Eastern Kentucky. And immediately, he had an incredible impact. There was, in his second week, he did a story about how they didn't have running drinking water, clean water, in one of the counties. And this was not the first time it had happened. They'd been kind of beaten down by how bad it was. But because no one had been listening, he did, and he did basic local reporting. And within a month, the person running the water district was forced out. And a month later, the state legislature came up with $5 million to help fix the water problem. So it's just and the thing that was fascinated me about this was that this was not like a 6 month long investigation. This was his second week on the job that he started writing about it. It's just that it had become so barren that people who had been complaining about this really serious problem had just not been taken seriously.
Well, also joining us by phone is Chris Six, editor of the Fauquier Times in Virginia. Chris Six, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Chris, what pitch would you make right now, if you had to Stephen Waldman, for a reporter that you need?
Well, I agree. I mean, you know, he's talking about gaps, and that's probably the biggest change that I've seen in the last 20 years, is this, how newsrooms have shrunk and we're trying to do so much more with so less. It's kind of like being in a leaking boat and poking your, you know, as many fingers as you can into the holes to keep it going. But yeah, we try to cover specific beats, and for us, of course, in Fauquier County, it's about land use and environment, and those would be the types of things that we'd be looking for.
Yes, Fauquier is a rural county. How would you describe the climate for local journalism out in Fauquier County, which is just west of Prince William County?
It's interesting. First off, of course, we also have a paper in Prince William County, so we have two very diverse audiences between the two counties. Fauquier County has been a county that has been focused on controlling growth and trying to preserve its flavor that it's had, for its rural flavor. We're in kind of a unique situation where we're a locally owned newspaper. We also have a web-based news site that's competition for us. So we have it's a little old school in that we get to, you know, go up against some competition, but we also have just local interested ownership. We're not owned by a large conglomerate that, you know, as Penny was saying earlier, also owns real estate and other investments.
And I'm glad you brought Penny up, because Penny, I think this will be particularly important for you and your study, because Chris, you have said that people in more rural areas like yours prefer actual newspapers to digital, and that has to do with the challenge of getting internet service. How does that affect the local paper?
Well, it's given us kind of an edge. Newspapers have come to digital so far behind the eight ball. For us, it's given us a little bit of extra breathing room because the rural areas in the northern part of the county, and actually several parts of the county, don't have access to broadband. You have readers who still want a hard copy newspaper in their hands every week. So in one hand, we're a weekly newspaper. On the other hand, we are making that move to digital. Again, like I say, we serve Prince William, which is a much more digitally adept county right now. And so on one hand, we're a weekly. On the other hand, we're 24/7 news operation.
Benny Muse Abernathy, care to comment?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of interesting points that both Chris raised, and to give credit where credit is due, Steve Waldman did the FCC report in 2011, who talked about a potential digital divide between areas that had broadband, and that can be even inner-city neighborhoods, but areas that had broadband and those that didn't or had access to the digital revolution. So I think that one of the issues that we saw in papers that had folded or communities that had lost papers is that there was a general lack of access to information. That was confirmed by a study that was done recently by Stanford that looked at the lack of access that people who live in low-income areas have to news and information. There's another interesting study that came out of Duke a couple of 3 months ago that looked at 100 communities and found that communities that were actually in metro areas, close into metro areas, actually had less local news than communities that were just outside the metro area. And they attributed that to the loss of a local community newspaper. And we certainly saw, when we looked at and categorized newspapers, the 1,800 that had been lost, we saw that more than half had been lost in either inner-city neighborhoods or in the suburbs, something you would not expect going in. You would think it would be off in the rural areas where there are not enough people to support a newspaper.
Got to take a short break, but before we do, Adrian tweets, I still mourn the loss of local newspapers, especially the Gazette. Though it can't replace detailed local reporting, vote411.org by the League of Women Voters is a great source of information for local candidates and issues. When we come back, we will talk a little bit more about the public service approach to reporting and how that may be able to help local newspapers. Still taking your calls if you've called, 800-433-8850. Stay on the line. I'm Kojo Nam. Welcome back to our conversation on News Deserts. I'd like to start right now with Stephen Waldman, president and co-founder of Report for America. Stephen, the challenge for local papers is usually a financial one. So how are Report for America people paid?
So they get paid an entry-level salary, and we're splitting the cost three ways. It's part of why it's able to work and help out local communities. So we, Report for America, are paying half the salary, and the local newsroom pays a portion. And then we work together to try to get support from the community, local donors, local foundations, things like that. And it's partially based on a premise that we should really face facts that the traditional commercial models are not going to fix this problem. The digital disruption is too profound. And we need to start thinking of this as a civic responsibility, just as a community might support libraries or museums or charitable organizations. The community also has to help support local journalism, especially civically important journalism of the sort that may not ever make a whole lot of money, but is really important to the health of a community.
Alexa, and, okay, go ahead, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, and just from the point of view of the reporter, it is to try to underline the idea of journalism, local journalism, as public service. And as we know, a lot of journalists get into it for that reason. They think that's what they're doing, but it kind of gets ground out of them by the business models, by the reality, the economic realities. So we're trying to create a way where journalists and news organizations can kind of re-embrace the public service mission.
Let me go around the table on this one before I go to the phone, starting with you, Alexa Mills, editor of Washington City Paper. Do you see this public service model for local journalism as a possible way forward?
Absolutely. I think that it's an excellent idea, and I think that it's incumbent upon us to explore, you know, all the possibilities, all the models in public service journalism is essential. I think that as an alt-weekly, we have a tradition of public service journalism that we've been able to hold on to. But Stephen is absolutely correct. There are great articles out there and things that we'd like to write about that we're not. You know, we know the stories are there.
Alexa's got a pitch for you too, Steve.
Good.
Doug Tallman, senior editor of Montgomery Community Media, former editor of the Montgomery Gazette. Do you see this public service model as a way forward?
I see it as our roots. Of course, it's our way forward.
It's our life.
No reporter, I think, didn't at least have this in the back of their mind when they chose this profession. It certainly wasn't for the money or the glamour or the nice hours.
Next up, you, Chris Six, editor of the Fauquier Times in Virginia.
I'd agree with everyone and what they've said. I mean, I think it's a little about what we're trying to do here. Our investment group got involved because they saw the need for the newspaper and the service that it provides. And I think that's just a natural philosophy that we're carrying into what we do.
And your investment group is local, right?
Yes.
How is the paper doing financially?
We're facing a lot of the same issues that other newspapers are facing, but I think what we're doing is we're being very open-minded towards new revenue streams and how to work with them, and a lot of the digital opportunities that, again, I think, Penny has gone into. We've actually had a couple of meetings with Penny's organization. We've kind of taken some of that philosophy and run with it.
You'll be happy to know that Paul writes on our Facebook page, WAMU and especially Kojo do a great job of covering the DMV, but as a Fauquier County resident, I feel that WAMU could do a much better job of covering statewide Virginia politics. Perhaps you could start this cycle, as we are about to elect our entire General Assembly in 2019. Paul, we will do the best we can. But before I go to the phones, Penny Muse Abernathy, the public service model for local journalism, do you see that as a way forward?
Well, that's basically the motivation for me for my life, first as a reporter and then when I switched over to the business side. I think it's vitally important that we find a business model, whether it's a for-profit or even a non-profit in areas that can't support it. And I like what Steve is doing because it begins to look at multiple models for the way forward. We have found that in communities like Fauquier, where you have an economic base, you can develop a way forward. There's no guarantee of success for any newspaper right now, but we really need strong newspapers down at both the grassroots level, and I would argue, too, we need them at the state and regional level. One of the valuable public service components of the journalism that state and regional governments have historically done are the investigative pieces that show us how a problem in an adjacent county or even in a county that's way away from us reflects on us. So I like the notion that a good, strong newspaper shows you how you're related to people you may not know you're related to. And as Steve pointed out, builds social cohesion as well as political involvement.
Here's David in Falls Church, Virginia. David, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. It seems like local politics is often the hidden apparatus that enables national politics through gerrymandering and voter registration, ID laws, etc. So with the death of local news, how are local political machines taking advantage of the lack of credible news to drive their agenda?
Penny?
Well, I think in a vacuum of news, you can one of the advantages of having, as journalists used to call it, boots on the ground, covering local politics, covering local meetings, covering state legislature, the state legislature, is you had people who were actually there reporting the facts and holding people accountable, and there's just a lack of accountability. You can operate in darkness, and you can use that all sorts of purposes that may never, no one may ever shine a light on.
Indeed, Doug Tallman, in Montgomery County right now, there's a race for county executive in which the details of development and economic policy are a part of the issue. How important is the local newspaper in that situation?
The local press is where that information is getting shared, and it's where the facts are being shared. I mean, there's an awful lot of opinion that's being bandied about, but the facts are being shared by the handful of local news organizations, which are, in large part, blogs and news sites
Kevin in Germantown represents one such. Kevin, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello, guys. How are you? Good to be with you. Doug's right. It's really difficult sometimes. I mean, I do the Germantown Pulse here in Germantown. I focus on Germantown, but as a part of Montgomery County, I have to look at what's going on at the county level. For me, I'm a one-man operation. I cover everything that happens in Germantown, and therefore, for me to cover the election, the three-way election for a county executive, as a one person, 24/7, and do something else is almost impossible. So I haven't really been giving it the exposure it should have as a journal, and I know this. So I'm disappointed in myself, and I've heard from my readers that my coverage has been disappointing. But as a small-time operation, which is what I am, I'm a blog. I hate to call myself a blog, but I am. It is a difficult, time-consuming situation where you have to get it right, you have to get it fair, and you have to be accurate, which is something that the local newspapers used to be able to do because they had a staff.
Kevin, thank you. And for the record, thank you for what you do. Here's Margaret in Springfield, Virginia. Margaret, your turn.
Hello. I want to say that this is an amazing conversation, and I'm so glad that you're having it, because right now with the internet and social media and all of this kind of stuff, we're very lazy about gathering our information. As a librarian, I love finding information for people, and you can't just go by one source. You have to exhaust your resources. And it's unfortunate that newspapers are going out of style, because that's one piece of the puzzle that you have to have. With 24-hour news, we're so saturated, but with a newspaper, we get the little tidbits that we need, and we can go from there and look for more information. And with that, I'm also wondering if any of your panelists would agree with me on this one. But we we raise taxes for libraries and schools. Why not a small tax for newspapers, even though people probably won't want to pay more taxes?
Penny Muse Abernathy, we only have about a minute left.
Well, there are at least a couple of people who've actually raised that idea, too. I'm pointing out that we tended to look at this as a market failure, and instead what we should be looking at it as a right for us as citizens. We have a right to get the access and be informed about the decisions we're making, so that it should be, journalism should be looked at as a not just a public good, but a merit good, along the lines of what we do with libraries, along the lines of what we do with school lunches and the like.
And I'm afraid that's about just all the time we have. Penny Muse Abernathy is the Knight Chair in Journalism and Digital Media Economics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Penny Muse Abernathy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Stephen Waldman is president and co-founder of Report for America, an organization that places emerging journalists in community newsrooms around the country. Before you go, Steve Waldman, do you see any signs of light here as a result of this conversation or what you're doing?
Well, I do, because one of the premises of our approach is that we don't need to create new news organizations. There are already great journalists and editors out there, like the people who have had this conversation. They just need help. They just need reporters and boots on the ground. And if they get that kind of help, they can do great work. And I would just mention, if you don't mind, that we are now right in the middle of the application process for both reporters and news organizations. So any news organizations listening or any reporters who might be interested in being a part of Report for America, please do consider that.
Contacting you right now. Thank you for joining us, Stephen. Alexa Mills is editor of Washington City Paper. Alexa, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kojo.
Doug Tallman is senior editor of Montgomery County Media. Doug, thank you.
Thank you.
And Chris Six is editor of the Fauquier Times in Virginia. Chris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's it for today's show. Today's conversation on local news deserts was produced by Julie Deppenbrock. Today's conversation on Amazon was produced by Lauren Marco. Coming up tonight, I'll be hosting an election night special with political analyst Tom Sherwood and the WAMU news team. Coverage starts at 8 p.m. Join us for a roundup of regional election results and analysis. That's tonight at 8. Thank you for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, Julie Deppenbrock, Margaret Barthel, and Lauren Marco. Our managing producer is Ingelisa Schroepsdorf. Our intern is Talia Drayton. Our engineer is Josephine Neonai. For past shows and more content, go to kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.